You're listening to Faith for Normal People, the only other God-ordained podcast on the internet.
I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias. Hey everybody, last chance to pay what you can for our May class with Dan McClellan and our very own Pete Enns called Myth Busting the Bible, where they're going to be talking about the big aha moments that changed how they see the Bible. As always, the class will be followed by a live Q&A with Dan and Pete, and the cost is pay what you can until the class ends, and then it'll cost $25 for the recording.
If you can't make it to the live class, no worries. You can still sign up during our pay what you can window and watch it back later. And as always, members of our online community, the Society of Normal People, will get an exclusive Q&A after the class.
To sign up, head to thebiblefornormalpeople.com /mythbustingthebible and mark your calendar for May 28th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time.
Hey everybody, today on Faith for Normal People, we're talking about the diversity of Islam with Adis Dudaria.
Yep, and Adis is a first-generation Bosnian Australian. And he's currently professor of in the study of Islam in Australia.
Yeah, and he tells his story pretty much at the beginning, too. So we're going to have some fun with that. So anyway, don't forget to stay tuned afterwards for a quiet time where Jared and I will process some of this stuff a little bit more deeply. And let's get right into this episode.
As difficult as it is, especially in this context, to try to divorce an Islam from geopolitical events. Contemporary Islam is dealing with the same issues that every other major world religion is dealing with. We are just as complex like anyone else. So meet us at the human-to-human level and just be aware that life is always more complex, more complicated than labels.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Adis, welcome to the podcast. It's really great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be with you.
Absolutely. So can you talk a little bit about your upbringing and how that informed your faith, just to give us a little context?
So I was born in Bosnia. At that time, it was Yugoslavia, socialist Yugoslavia. I was born in the late 70s. Until I was about 14, 15 years old, and then all the trouble started. I'm not sure how much you know about the history of that region. And then I ended up living in Germany for a while, and due to various reasons, ended up in Australia as a 19-year-old. So I'm a first-generation Bosnian-Australian, married to an Indonesian with two wonderful children. So I grew up in a socialist Yugoslavia where religion was probably somewhat marginalized. It was somewhat hidden as well. And my parents were of a generation who really kind of grew up, and their formative years were that part of that socialist cultural, intellectual milieu. So my parents were probably that most secularized generation that ever existed probably in the region. And so I grew up as, I guess, a cultural Muslim. My grandma used to live with us as a child. My father's mother, she had a little bit more kind of religious influence on me. She taught me some basic Arabic forms of supplication, and I would see her do the, you know, traditional Muslim prayer. But I had very limited exposure to the Islamic faith as a young person. We would basically celebrate the major festivals, but they were kind of an expression of our cultural heritage rather than being an expression of kind of conscious faith, if I can put it that way. I guess when I started university in Australia, I became a little bit more self-aware and kind of more intellectually mature. And that was around the time of, it was actually prior to 9/11. I already got involved in interfaith-related activities at my university. I was part of the Muslim Student Association, vice president, and then president. But yeah, I was always interested in interfaith dialogue, and then co-founded an interfaith group in Perth. I used to live in Perth in Western Australia. That's where I did my PhD as well. Currently, I reside in Brisbane, which is Griffith University in Brisbane. So, like as in my late teens, early 20s, I was very much interested in interfaith dialogue, and I also got exposed to modernist, progressive, or modernist at that time. Really, the word progressive wasn't used that much. Modernist Muslim thinking. Certain scholars, I don't know if your audience probably was not going to be familiar with them, but there was one very famous modernist Muslim thinker who used to teach at McGill University and University of Chicago by the name of Fazlur Rahman. Luckily, I guess my most serious introduction into my faith was primarily through academic literature. Although in terms of my lived experience, as I said, I was part of the Muslim Student Association at my university. I met a lot of Muslims who come from very different backgrounds. Australia has like Muslims from 150 different cultural and ethnic backgrounds. I also met some international students who were studying at the university, many of them from Southeast Asia. And, you know, I often ask myself the question, well, you know, how come there's so very different expressions of the Islamic faith? You know, why do I follow or why do I believe in the kind of Islam that I believe in? And that kind of triggered my interest in my what eventually became my PhD thesis, which was comparing progressive Islamic approach to interpreting normative Islamic texts to that of the Puritanicals. So it's the same text, but very, very different interpretations. Around just after 9/11, there was a very significant, from my perspective, book published called and it used the word progressive Muslims, omitted by Professor Omid Safi, who now teaches at Duke University. So I kind of fell in love with that book, and I said, well, if there's one thing I want to do for the rest of my life is to contribute to that kind of Islam, you know.
You're sparking our imaginations here with this. And to talk maybe a little bit about the diversity in Islamic thought, which may not be the same thing as diversity in Islamic religion. I mean, you know, there are in Christianity, you have the theologians and those who do the thinking, but on the ground, it's a very different thing. And a question that I hate getting is, hey, Pete, what do Christians think about X, Y, or Z? And I said, you've got to be kidding me, right? They think all different kinds of things. But I think people look at Islam, at least who don't know much about it, and say, well, this is just a monolithic movement. And that's not true.
There's definitely that. Look, I'm very pleased that I can actually speak from an empirical vantage point here, because my colleague here and I, well, my colleague is much more into sociology of religion than myself. So 3-4 years ago, we did this really major study, although it was restricted to the Australian context, but I think it could be extrapolated, especially in relation to Muslims in the West more generally. So we did this really comprehensive survey followed by focus groups on various expressions of Islam in Australia. And one of the questions, there were like 150 questions, but one of the questions we were really keen on is we were already aware of the literature on different typologies of being a Muslim, different Islamic orientations, intellectual Islamic orientations. And we kind of extracted the most important kind of delineating features of each one of these. And we asked people, okay, here are all these descriptors of different ways of being a Muslim. For example, one descriptor is my understanding of Islam aligns with religious pluralism, gender justice, and social justice, something along those lines. And then another one might have been, you know, I'm a practicing Muslim who believes that, I don't know, Islamic law needs reforming or whatever. You know, we kind of map them in accordance with these existing typologies. And I'll talk about these typologies of Islamic orientations, but I'll tell you the result first, which was actually surprising So we had these 9 or 10 typologies. I might as well mention them right now. Classical scholasticism. These are your theologians in the biblical sense, kind of like classical scholasticism, or so we've got them as well. I mean, there's many parallels between Islam and Christianity in that sense. So we've got these classical kind of traditionalist Muslims, like your average imam in the mosque, for example. Then you would have what we call conservative political Islamists, who theologically are very similar to classical traditionalists, but they have a much more robust political vision. I don't know, I'm trying to find a group, like some groups in Turkey, maybe like Erdogan, AKP, some more reformist forms of, I don't want to make this a political thing, but certain groups in the Middle East would also fall under this category that have been in the news, although they can range from reformist to more kind of very conservative. So we've got the political conservative political Islamists, who are all about restoring the caliphate, the utopia from the past. Then we would have more reformist-minded political Islamists who still believe that Islam should have should play a serious role in politics, but it's not wedded to the classical political Islamic theology of the past. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they are more likely to accept democracy and kind of constitutional democracy and parliament-based kind of politics. Yeah. Then you would have the cultural nominalists, who express the Islam primarily or exclusively through the ethnic and cultural belonging. Mm-hmm. Then you would have the puritanicals. You might have heard of the Salafis. Yeah. The puritanicals, theological puritanicals, who are apolitical. So they're all about the importance of following the correct doctrine. So they're all about puritanical doctrines, like what you should believe in to be a proper Muslim. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it seems like you can really map onto, I can hear echoes in Christianity. I can hear echoes in Judaism, the different varieties. It's interesting. I mean, that's a sociological issue, in a sense, that you have these different ways of expressing a religious faith. And it looks like, the three major world religions, as they call them, it's the same.
The more I get to learn about Christianity and other religions, the more similarities I see. I haven't actually finished these three more categories, but I think it's important. I mean, I'm teaching this course now next week, Islam and Muslims in the West. And the first thing I'm going to talk to them about, I'm going to introduce these intellectual orientations. It's important because, number one, many of my students are non-Muslims, and they have, they've been exposed to certain views of what Islam is and who a Muslim is. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to them about this, they feel so liberated. They feel like, I don't have to be politically correct if I say that there are certain forms of Islam that are definitely problematic. And I'm highly critical of a number of forms of Islam. So, but they also see the diversity, so they feel like, wow, yeah, like there's much more to Islam than this. And they can kind of be critical of certain forms of Islam without being being labeled Islamophobe or, kind of politically, they have to be politically correct but kind of hide their true opinions behind it. But so the other three are basically the militant extremists who combine puritanical theology with the political kind of ideology. Then we have the mystic, the Sufis, and then we have the progressives, who combine the best of all and leave the worst behind.
And you're a progressive, right?
I very much I am a progressive.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
I appreciate getting all of the categories. I appreciate that you pushed through Pete interrupting you and continued on. But within those categories, you know, for Christians, there's, even within our categories, the Bible still has a certain place in our faith. It's sort of, everybody has to deal with the Bible in one way or the other because it is such a part, inextractable part of our faith. So what role does the Quran play within Islam broadly, if you can say that? And then what are the different ways that it's handled within maybe a couple of these different variations?
Sure. So the vast amount of people and like Islamic clergy, people who are practicing Muslims, they would adhere to the doctrine of the idea that the Quran is a verbatim word of God, so which was a doctrine they developed early. Well, not necessarily early, but it kind of, the Orthodox view won in like probably in the 4th century of the Islamic calendar. So this is about end of 4th, beginning of 5th. So 11th century Common Era. There are all these kind of doctrines like the inimitability of the Quranic language, it's called Ijaz al-Quran, that took a couple of hundred years to develop and kind of to consolidate itself. But very early in Islamic theology, there was this question of, it emerged as a result of certain theological debate about pertaining to the nature of God's attribute. And God's speech was one of these attributes. So is God's speech part of God's essence, or is it more kind of incidental? And where does the Quran fit into all of this as a form of revelation? So the mainstream orthodoxy, which still holds a lot of sway among practicing Muslims and in major Islamic institutions, seminaries, is that the idea that Quran is uncreated God's speech, and God's speech as one of the attributes of God is co-eternal with God, and therefore Quran has this meta-historical quality to it. So this is very much emphasized by basically all forms of Islam apart from progressive Muslim thought. Progressive Muslim thought is informed by constructive postmodernism. Okay, so the idea of any kind of meta-narrative, any kind of objective truth is problematic, to say the least. I'm actually now working on a paper on kind of the affinities between process relational concept of revelation and that of in progressive Islam, so maybe we can go into that. But essentially, progressive Muslim thought accepts the criticism of process relational metaphysics that it is untenable to say that a text would correspond to like that there is purely metaphysically divine text. Yeah. But and that the form of that revelation can take various forms and degrees. It can get really technical, but progressive Muslim thought still takes Quran very seriously as a revelation without the capital R. Yeah, as right. A form of revelation. Because the Quran, I mean, when you look at the Quran talks about natural phenomena as ayatullah, as forms of signs of God. Even the Quran talks about how if human beings look into themselves, they will find signs of God in themselves. So it's a much broader concept of revelation. It's not restricted to a textualist form of revelation. And also it talks about, you know, it talks about, for example, even like bees, bees who do what they do every day, they have been inspired by God to do what they do. So like there's different forms of revelation. They come in different degrees, but they all have, I guess, a contingent contextualist element to them. And like the scope of the concept of revelation is much broader. It's not just restricted to a text.
Yeah, so I think it would be fun to maybe get into some of that around mm-hmm. revelation. But before we mm-hmm. leave these categories, what's the difference between a progressive Islam and a cultural nominalist? Because those have some parallels, I think, within Christianity.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'm mm-hmm. trying to think of the differences of how I would articulate that within the Christian faith. But how would you distinguish between those two in Islam?
So I guess the most important distinction here is that they could often come to the same conclusions, although like progressives would work through the tradition, they would deconstruct it, reconstruct it, and say that we should leave many things from the past to be in the past. Kind of cultural nominalists and secularists, I guess, they come to the same conclusion. They have the same kind of world, same ideas, but they do it subconsciously or without actually being conservant with the tradition.
Yeah, they take the easy road out, which is how it is over here too. We got to like struggle and we have to strain through it all, and mm-hmm. then we deconstruct it, and then other people are like, yeah, we've just been doing that since the 70s. We just kind of show up.
Yeah, well, not all of us have the luxury of being, you know, philosophers, theologians, and do this for a living. if I was to kind of delineate between the two, that would be probably the most important.
I think that has some real clear parallels, I would say, to how we would think of that too. Sort of people who
absolutely
grew up culturally, you know, in the South here in the States. I think a lot of people would be culturally nominalist in their Christianity.
Yeah.
They just kind of go with whatever they inherited. If it's more progressive, they stick with that. If it's more conservative, they stick with that because it's more of a cultural phenomenon than a religious one. And then the more progressive, I think that is more of a label of people that have maybe deconstructed or kind of reconfigured mm-hmm. Their faith in a, you know, in a different way. So I appreciate that. But maybe, I don't know, P, do you have a follow-up on the revelation thing? Because I think that's really interesting, you mentioning process relational metaphysics. Mm-hmm. I tend to think of that as a very Western mm-hmm. kind of post-Christian way of thinking of, you know, secularized thinking that, I mean, not yeah. always. I think it's made its way into theological circles for sure.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that it's coming up there.
I mean, one question is, how long has this been a conversation in Islam, you know, a process theology? I mean, this has been a part of, you, as you know better than I do, that, you know, the early part of the 20th century is when these things started becoming part of Christian conversations. And did Islam come along a bit later, or was it always there from the beginning? There was always these progressive types, as you are, who were willing to engage these kinds of new and potentially dangerous ideas.
Yeah, okay. So if we take off the cutoff period for process relational metaphysics with Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne in like beginning of 20th century, then probably the first major figure in the Islamic world who read Whitehead and kind of try to consciously integrate some of the ideas into Islam is someone called Allama Muhammad Iqbal, who is the intellectual father of Pakistan, which could be very surprising for people. Like today's image of Pakistan is anything but. So he read Whitehead and he was influenced by a process. By kind of an organic cosmos, a cosmos that is kind of not substance, Newtonian, but a process, kind of continually in process. Everything is kind of interconnected and interrelated. And mm-hmm. he found certain ideas in the Quran and the Islamic tradition, especially in the Quran, for example, and this is again a parallel with Christianity, the idea that God appointed humanity to be the steward. His stewards on planet Earth, on Earth, and kind of, you know, to kind of do God's bidding. Yeah. And in Islamic tradition, the concept that's used, like the Quran uses the concept, it's called khilafa or khalifa. Khalifa is the noun, the God's deputy on earth, which in, of course, in classical theism is premised on a kind of a duality. Yeah. Which kind of process relational theology reject. But Allama Muhammad Iqbal basically took this concept, this idea of stewardship, and he said, well, God has given human beings free will and agency, so we are kind of co-creators with God. Yeah. So, and this is where the link with process relational theology or metaphor kind of even is. This idea of co-creation, that God doesn't unilaterally determine events. God is not, Allama Muhammad Iqbal kind of picked up on that.
Can I ask a question just for clarification? I'm thinking, because these are new concepts, I think, for a lot of us and for a lot of our listeners. What you're describing now would be rejected, clearly, by, let's say, more traditionalists in the Islamic faith, what we would call maybe fundamentalists or something, right? So, and the reason they reject it is because they see the Quran as transhistorical. It's not affected by, it's God's speech and it's contextless. I mean, because process theology developed because of a context. Things were happening in the world of science and people started to think differently about these things. That's off the table completely. In that more, I'm going to use the word conservative element in the Islamic world, correct?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So they, the orthodoxy, what today counts as orthodoxy, they have invested very heavily in this meta-historical approach to revelation, and that Muhammad basically was just a vessel, that there was this external angel who poured revelation into his empty brain and delivered it. Yeah, Muhammad's psychological, cognitive, imaginative, or even cultural or historical context had absolutely nothing to do with it. So they because Islamic theology, and this is probably something that people don't appreciate as much, really developed in the context of two well-established monotheistic traditions, Christianity and Judaism, it often was reacting to. So there was to understand this context, to understand this insistence on Quran being the pure word of God, we have to go back into these earlier debates between Christian, especially Christian theologians, because when Islam kind of expanded very quickly. Or let's say the Arab Muslims conquered many large parts of Mediterranean and the MENA region, yeah. And Muslims were a minority for hundreds of years, yeah. And they conquered places that had well established, you know, culturally well established, theologically very well established, and they were kind of an early Islam. Actually, this is quite also very interesting. There's a lot of now critical scholarship coming out, talking about how early Islam was an ecumenical Judeo-Christian movement that early on was indistinguishable, probably not, it was a kind of a continuity of certain forms of Judeo-Christian, Judeo-Christianity, if you like. Mm-hmm. So, but then, kind of over time, you know, as Islam became an empire of faith, and the political leaders understood how important it is to make more distinction between Islam and Judeo-Christianity, they started to kind of engage in kind of forms of apologetic discourses that kind of to carve out theological and discursive space for a new religion. So they said, okay, there's a doctrine in Islamic theology, early Islamic theology, called tahrif. Meaning distortion of revelation by previous religions, especially in Christianity. This distortion, some people would say, okay, it's not willful. It's just the people who have been misinterpreting it. And so So now this nascent Islamic faith, they said, we don't want to make the same mistake. You know, we want inerrancy, you know. So we,
yes.
Therefore, the only way to maintain this inerrancy is to say that, you know, the Quran has not been written by human beings. It is purely divine. It has been preserved 100% in its divine form, not like other religious traditions, you know, that Muslims have encountered, especially, you know, Christianity, mm-hmm. Judaism, Zoroastrianism. So it came out of that kind of intellectual milieu, yeah.
When would that have developed, just historically? When are you thinking, like, that idea of it? We need to protect this inerrancy so that it doesn't get, you know, when did that come about?
As far as we can tell, it started under a certain person called Abdul Malik, who was one of the, I don't know how well you know Islamic history, but the first dynasty, they're called the Umayyads, all right? Mm-hmm. And they kind of ruled from 50 years after Muhammad's death until up to 120 years after Muhammad's death.
One generation removed.
Okay. So they, although initially they were very much, if you look at the coins that they have minted, the Umayyads, they all have Jesus with the Christ on them. They minted because they were part of the Byzantine cultural and religious context. So, and as I said, early Islam, as far as we can tell, was a very much an ecumenical movement. It didn't have a strong, self-identity. Because mm-hmm. you might know that early Muslims actually were praying initially towards Jerusalem, and only later on they started praying towards Mecca. You know, and the Holy Rock Dome is also, you know, very important to Muslims, and of course it has mm-hmm. Judaic important. So towards the late Umayyads, I think this crystallization of Muslim identity started to appear. But then the new rulers, the Abbasids, they kind of capitalized on this and wanted to deepen this rift between, or kind of to make Islam less ecumenical and make it a more distinct religion, so that they could also justify their own power to say that they are now they are mm-hmm. the ones who are ruling in the name of God and the Prophet, you know. So it's a very interesting historical development.
Well, yeah, it's like Christianity, isn't it? When you have the rise of, you know, after the beginnings, maybe rather innocent beginnings of Jesus and Paul, it didn't take long for this to be wrapped up in political power. And many would say we've been suffering ever since because of that. You know, just when you rule in God's name, right? If that's the purpose of religion, this mixing of faith and politics. I mean, it's not that they have to be separate, but you know what I mean. It's this civic religion that is such a big problem. It's so interesting to see these parallels to me.
Yeah, it is. So what within that? What is the? I was curious to know. You know, for the relationship of these different traditions, like how do they see each other? So for us, like, conservative Christians wouldn't really even call progressive Christians true Christians. Mm-hmm. They don't, there's not a sense of like, oh yeah, there's all these different expressions. It's more like, I think more historically or, you know, sociologists would certainly put them all in the same camp. But from the perspective of a conservative Christian, they'd be like, well, they're not true Christians. Is that similar to kind of who are the gatekeepers of this orthodoxy in Islam, and how do the different perspectives see each other?
Okay, so I know how far you want me to go back in history, but what happened, I think, as far as Sunni Islam, let's just focus on Sunni Islam here. Islam, you know, there's Sunni and like Shi'i, and one could, and within Shi'ism, there is different expressions. Within Sunnism, there are also very different expressions. So in about 11th, 12th century, Common Era, Sunni Orthodoxy kind of crystallized, and they said, where I have these four major legal schools of thought, and we will say that they are all core orthodox, Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, and Hanbali. All right. So there was this agree to disagree within these parameters of legal thought. In addition, there are theological schools that also would have legal components to them. So Sunnism accept, now you put me on the spot, the Salafis or the Atharis, which are the Puritanicals. Although there's some debate about this, every now and then it flares up. Like in Chechnya in 2016 or 17, they had all these Sunni clerics coming together and deciding what is Sunni Islam, what is not Sunni Islam. This is in the context of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. They were like saying, you know, we are true Muslims, and then, you know, like then so all these other clerics said, oh, we have to do something about this. You know, we don't want people to think that the mainstream Sunni Islam is represented by ISIS. And they said, okay. And because ISIS is very kind of puritanical theologically, they didn't want this puritanical form of Islam to be also considered part of Sunni Islam. But in truth, it has always been part of Islam from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. So like this puritanical strands, which is the Athari, Salafi kind of, yeah. But then you have something called the Maturidis, Maturidiya, who are, let's say, the most well, with alongside the Asharis, and these are the two major, in terms of geographical spread today, they are the most well established and like, in terms of, at least nominally, like people, like, for example, I was born into a Hanafi legal school, and my theological orientation is Maturidi. He was a scholar who lived in the 4th century somewhere in Central Asia. And then basically it all has to do with the free will and the relation between reason and revelation. Like, yeah, it's got to do with so Asharis, well, again, the same thing in Christianity. So there's these four or five major theological schools and four major legal schools. And I forgot what your question is. So in terms of rivalry, there has always been rivalry. So even in pre-modern times, we there's like examples of pogroms, or even within Sunnism, of scholars burning each other's scholars' books, or one scholar inciting a group of his followers to go and smash the mosque of another scholar. Like, you know, some scholars have been poisoned by others, or, you know, very, very ugly stories there, unfortunately. So a lot of rivalry at the scholar to scholar level, as well as kind of territorial different schools of thought. In today's context, biggest arch rivals are Puritanical Salafis versus Sufis, and because Sufis are often associated with the classical scholasticism kind of people, so you have these rivalries between, I guess in the Christian context it would be between Puritanical Evangelical Bible trumping versus kind of scholastic Catholic.
Okay.
Catholic scholasticism. Mm-hmm. I guess that would probably be. I might have offended a few people here right now, but but it's that kind of, you know. In my view, like the way I look at Catholic Christianity, it's all about the founding fathers and building upon the kind of this speculative theology. So that's kind of classical scholasticism in Islam is like that. Whereas Puritanicals are more like, forget about the tradition and all these, we go back straight back to the Quran and the Hadith.
Yeah.
That's a good parallel. I think that's right.
Yeah.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knete ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Barra ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 GB für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd.
Lelelele.
Lebara, deine Knete. deine Entscheidung.
Nice!
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter libara.de.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
I'm thinking here of, again, of our listeners who I think will be really interested in learning more about the diversity of Islam. So where would you point them? I know you wrote a book, but my guess is that's probably going to be more of high-level academic treatment of progressive Islam. Do you have any resources just to come to mind where people can say, listen, if you want to get the big lay of the land here, of Islam, of its diversity, do you have any place to point them? By the way, I hate that question myself because I have to think about it long and hard. That's not an easy question to answer. And what are the best books that cover all the territory? It doesn't work that way, but anything come to mind at all?
Yeah, you know, and you might find this funny, but I'm going to say it nonetheless. So as you said, as you rightly pointed out, I have been writing on progressive Islam in an academic context now for 17 years. And as I've quoted, it's all behind paywalls. And although I've tried to kind of proselytize it as much as I could on academia.edu and all of these places. But then I said to myself, okay, you know, I had a long road towards, you know, securing an academic, full-time academic position. It took me 7 years after PhD and so on. So I thought, okay, it just occurred to me earlier this year, oh, maybe I can get rich, but if I write a short book.
I'm telling you, took the words out of my mouth. I think you might. Yeah, I mean, you would be able to, with the breadth of learning that you have, I think that's a great idea. I mean, honestly, well, to like so Islam for the rest of us or something. I don't know.
I set up my own personal website, and I wrote a collection of essays on critical progressive Islam available on my website for $5. So,
okay.
It's going to take you a while to get rich.
And since I launched my website in February this year, I managed to sell 15 books.
That's fantastic.
But look, I've also written stuff. Like I do a regular column for a website called newageislam.com. It's based in India. And there's also some free stuff that I've written, so you don't really need to buy the book. But if you wanted a holistic and at an accessible level,
So what I'm hearing you saying is just Google you, right? Google your name, and things will come up. Okay, good.
They should. So if I was to summarize progressive Islam in a lay person's nomenclature. One of the essays I wrote for that short booklet, I kind of spelt it out in the title. I am a rationalist, feminist, critical thinker with Sufi mystical orientations, and in terms of my theology, I'm a process relational theologian. It's something like that. So all of those combined. Yeah, critical thought in the context of postmodernism. But not the radical kind of postmodernism of Derrida that just deconstructs for the sake of deconstruction, but there is a reconstructive element to it. Process relational theology, so that we reject the classical theistic God or a God who is, you know, has us on strings and, feminism is very important to me. I'm a pro-feminist male. I've written a lot on Islamic feminism. Critical thought, cosmopolitan identity. So this is like one of the things that I like about the Islamic tradition heritage, that cosmopolitan element or glimpses of it that it had in Andalusia, like given their context. And also mysticism, Islamic, for certain forms of Islamic philosophical mysticism, not everyday mysticism of these Muslim brotherhoods that you find attached to the mosque, but more philosophical mysticism of someone like Ibn al-Arabi, and you know, mm-hmm. certain Islamic philosophers like Avicenna, al-Farabi, so that kind. So there are antecedents of the kind of Islam I am projecting and defending, or I'm just re-articulating some of these trends in a postmodernist kind of context. And I also appreciate the critical historical approach to scripture. Mm-hmm. Without, of course, the latent scientism or materialism, I think. The faith can still survive the critical historical. Definitely the faith in its process relational mm-hmm. version can survive the critical historical critique.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up our time here, I'm wondering, is there something that kind of a final word for people who maybe don't know much about Islam? They haven't been around Muslims much, and they want to. You know, you talked earlier about being afraid of being Islamophobic and not really know how to navigate the space, which I think sometimes keep people from interacting mm-hmm. in a way that could be helpful for them. So what's a word as we end our time here for people who are saying, oh, I should probably get to know my Muslim neighbors a little bit better. You know, this is very interesting stuff. I just didn't have access to it. So what would you say to people who want to kind of more connect with people who are Muslim?
Thanks. That's a really important question. Probably the most important thing that we're going to discuss today. As difficult as it is, especially in this context, try to divorce Muslims from geopolitical events mm-hmm. and Islam from geopolitical events. So there are Muslims, obviously this goes without saying, are human beings with all the usual perks and you know, virtues and vices like anyone else. Try to meet them at the, you know, for who they are at their level. Often most Muslims do not have very good understanding of their faith, and many of the things I've talked about they probably wouldn't know, I mean, much mm-hmm. about anyway. Islam has had a strong cosmopolitan dimension that we are not aware of. It has been buried under contemporary geopolitical kind of discussions. Islam has a strong mystical spiritual tradition. People like Rumi and Hafez, you might have heard of them, mm-hmm. who are still kind of often I also listen to spirituality podcasts like Be Here Now Network. I don't know. They're based in San Francisco, I think. So often these kinds of people, I wouldn't say the word appropriate, but they use spirituality, mm-hmm. Muslim, like Islamic spirituality from the Rumi, Hafez, Ibn al-Arabi, the mystics. You know, think of Istanbul and the whirling dervishes. Contemporary Islam is dealing with the same issues that every other major world religion is dealing mm-hmm. with. We might be a little bit behind when it comes to critical historical kind of thought, when it comes to developing Islamic feminist theology, but we are catching up. We are catching up now in terms of Islamic feminism. We now have the second generation of Muslim female scholars who are developing Islamic feminism very robustly, learning from Christian feminist theology. So we are just as complex, just as, mm-hmm. like anyone else. So mm-hmm. meet us at the human to human level, and just be aware that life is always more complex, more complicated than labels. And And as I said, I'm highly critical of certain forms of Islam. I think that Puritanical Islam, classical Islam has nothing to little to offer. Like any other religion that's couched in those kinds of ideas, it has very little or nothing to offer to contemporary society. And I really sincerely hope that these forms of Islam will become less and less meaningful to more and more Muslims. And if Muslims mm-hmm. in the West, there are many Muslims in the West who are very progressive, liberal, secular, whatever, and you will find them partners, to be your partners in many different contexts for many different purposes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Addis. That was a fantastic way to end. I appreciate the way you articulated that. Yeah. So thanks so much for taking some time and talking to us through some. We got into more history than I was expecting, mm-hmm, yeah, and I was very. Absolutely.
And I'm glad we did.
My nerd side was real excited about that.
Thank you. I should be thanking you for. I should be thanking you for providing me with the platform to articulate these ideas. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Addis. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. We appreciate your time and the discussion.
And now for Quiet Time
with Pete and Jared. So, Jared, we had a really interesting discussion with Addis about some things that were totally new to me. And I don't know, what do you think? What challenge, did anything challenge or expand your understanding of Islam through Addis's lens of progressive theology and ethics? It's even weird saying that
exactly.
sentence, to be
honest
with you.
I think that's the thing that expanded, which, I mean, in theory, I knew that there were probably different variations of Islam, just like there are variations of Christianity. But I think the expansion was to get some specifics around what those variations are. And I was surprised by how well they mapped on to Christianity. So a lot of the conversation, I just kept thinking, what is it about humans that within these different religions, we kind of go through the same evolution or development, and some people sort of crystallize here and then other people crystallize here in a similar framework. So I think for me, that was the thing that challenged my thinking, or at least expanded it, was that there are these distinct ways of expressing Islam, and that those map onto, and I don't want to over-index overlay or project our experiences, but I just seem to also agree that there were these overlays.
Well, do you think that overlaying that these similar kinds of diverse expressions of a particular faith, do you think that's personality? Do you think it's education? Do you think it's social location? All of the above? Any of the above?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it also tracks with cultural developments. I do think there is a tendency for people in general I think of it as like moving along a path, and there will always be certain people who stop at separate encampments and says, this feels at home here.
Right.
I'm going to stay here. And that becomes its own movement and own way of being in the world. And then there's another one. And I think it goes on probably forever that way. But I think it's cultural in terms of the direction it goes. But then I think it's human that just different people have different temperaments to say, like, oh, I'm at home here. And then, you know, you pass that down and a couple of your kids are like, I'm at home here too. And a couple say, nah, I'm not at home. I'm going to move on to a
different
place.
We see that in the history of Christianity and Judaism. You know, that's so why should Islam be any different?
Well, I mean, in some ways, Islam is that out of the Abrahamic faith, right?
Yeah.
In the same way that Christianity is that out of Judaism.
Right.
So it happens at the micro level and at the macro level, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about you? Does anything else come to mind in terms of what expanded your thinking?
Yeah. I think the whole idea of the caricatures that I had, and not intentionally so, just I've never thought about it. So you have sort of these default ways of thinking. And, you know, I'll never talk again about, like, what Islam believes.
Right.
Right. Same thing as, like, when people say, you know, what do Christians think about X? Are you kidding me? You know, but the thing, it's the same elsewhere. And it gave me a sort of kinship that I had not really felt before. Cause I'm like, well, here we go again. We're all just people. We're all just people trying to make sense of reality. And we have religious traditions. I sometimes say the word system, which sounds awfully sterile. I don't mean it that way, but we have religious contours, flavors of the way of thinking about reality. And at some point, you know, to have that dialogue between them is just, I think, very, very enriching. That's sort of what we had with the episode, I think, you know. So, you know, stereotyping is so easy. I just don't want to do it.
Right. Yeah. Well, then I think that leads us to maybe another question I would have, which is, you know, how does this fit into a framework of pluralism or interfaith dialogue as we think about it socially and theologically, And maybe, how has that shifted for you? Maybe you have a different answer now than you would have had 20 mm-hmm. years ago.
Yeah, probably. I mean, for me, it started with my graduate school experience.
Right.
So I started to just get out of my own little bubble. And it's amazing, you know, the internet, that people are still in bubbles, I think,
right.
when we have access to so much information. But we watch what we want to watch. But I think the need for religious traditions to be in dialogue is only going to be greater the smaller our world becomes. Mm-hmm. And that's not a profound statement. People have said that for a very long time. But, you know, I see it, you know, I feel it more. I see it more certainly than I did 30 years ago. But, right. But you know, that always brings up that point of, you know, dialogue, but without destroying the distinctives of
right.
those traditions, right?
Right? Mm-hmm.
So it isn't just like we all get along and it's great. It's like, where are we different? Why do we differ? And, you know, agree to differ without killing each other, without
right.
maligning each other. And when you hear people like Addis, who's so very bright and so knowledgeable about so many things, like there's so much to talk about. There's
mm-hmm.
so much we have in common
right.
to see, you know, how do you handle this particular philosophical challenge,
mm-hmm.
let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do you handle this particular scientific challenge? Well, we're all sort of doing it. So, and here we are on this pale blue ball, right? As
mm-hmm.
Carl Sagan said, and we have a chance to actually dialogue with people from very different traditions. And that to me is exciting. That's expands our own consciousness. And then, you know, Christians have that job to go back and say, okay, now how do I envision the Christian faith
right.
in light of this
right, right.
when it's much more difficult to have them versus us?
Right.
You know, there are parts of the Bible, I think especially the Hebrew Bible, where it's a little bit easier, at least in portions of it, to sort of have that kind of us versus them mentality. Although even within the Hebrew Bible, that changes the book of Jonah, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just, it challenges me to again, embrace the idea that, and this is going to make people nervous, all religious traditions evolve.
Right.
Everything,
right.
it always evolves, it develops, whatever word you want to use,
mm-hmm.
but you cannot think Christianly today the way people thought Christianly 500 years ago, because
right.
stuff has happened.
Right. right. Well, and what you're saying too made me think of, there's also a shift in how we approach it, where I would think both of us, maybe 20 years ago or more, the frame of what Christianity is about
mm-hmm.
was more about being right.
Yeah.
There's a right way to think about God.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't very embodied or practical.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like, how do we handle social injustices or problems in the world that we're facing?
Yeah.
It was, who's theoretically correct about God? And that sets up these religious traditions in tension.
Right.
In a way that I think for me, I've sort of changed how I think about
mm-hmm.
that, where it is not, Islam is not a threat to my Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I can be firmly Christian and learn things from this tradition
mm-hmm.
because it's not going to change. I'm not in it to change anyone or change anything other than maybe change my approach
mm-hmm.
in very practical ways, like
mm-hmm.
how we address each other or how we address problems. Like you said, I could learn about, hey, Islam has these same philosophical challenges that we have in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
How do you guys do this?
Right.
And to say, like, we can learn from each other rather than, well, there's only one right way to think about God. And let me just look at the ways that you're wrong about God.
Mm-hmm.
And here are the ways that I'm right about God, and try to convince you in this, like, everything for me growing up was apologetics.
Right.
I was trying to defend
mm-hmm.
Christianity. And that doesn't, well, it just sort of keeps you isolated from learning
mm-hmm.
and growing, I think.
Yeah, and you know, I think of possible, I agree with you, I think of possible comebacks to that, like,
mm-hmm.
what about the Great Commission?
Right.
It's our job is to convert people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I understand that, I appreciate it, but it's not as if all Christians have always believed that's our only role as Christians, and now all of a sudden,
right.
you know, with the internet and air travel, you know, and cell phones, now all of a sudden we have this new problem no one's thought of before. This is, interreligious dialogue is very old in both,
yeah, right.
in the Christian tradition, you know,
mm-hmm.
and And it's just, we're seeing it again, because I think, like you said at the beginning, people sort of stop at certain points where they feel at home. Some right. people never quite feel at home. They're always finding a new place. Yep. Those are the people who are most likely to say, we just need to sit down mm-hmm. and talk to each other. You mm-hmm. know, just, I think you can love the other person more by understanding them, you know? Right. And I think that's fairly consistent with Christianity, yep. you know? And,
well, good. I hope this conversation does open up people to the idea of interfaith dialogue, having conversations with people, other religious traditions. And you may be surprised, as we somewhat were, mm-hmm. that there's all this diversity. There, who knows? If you've met one Muslim, you've probably met one Muslim.
Yeah.
Like, same with Christians. Like, we don't want mm-hmm. people to lump us in with certain yeah. versions of yeah. Christianity. And that was a good takeaway as well. So hopefully yeah. this leads to more conversation.
All right, folks.
Well, thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you want to support what we do, there are three ways you can do it. One, if you just want to give a little money, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/give.
And if you want to support us and want an all-access pass to our classes, ad-free live stream of the podcast, and a thoughtful community of people asking tough questions about the Bible and faith, you can become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People, at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
And lastly, it goes a long way if you just wanted to rate the podcast, leave a review, and tell others about our show. In addition, you can let us know what you thought about the episode by emailing us at info@thebiblefornormalpeople.com.
You've just made it through another episode of Faith for Normal People. Don't forget you can catch our other show, The Bible for Normal People, in the same feed wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team. Brittany Hodge, Stephen Henning, Joel Limbowen, Savannah Locke, Melissa Yando, Tessa Stoltz, Danny Wong, Lauren O'Connell, and Naomi Gonzalez.
If you can't make it to the live class, no worries. You can still sign up during the Oh, for heaven's sake. Just say pay what you can window.
I knew it. As soon as you read it, I was like, this is not the night for it. This is not the night for abbreviation.
Okay. All right. We're professionals. Shut up.